We have with us live in the studios once again, Jav Parrish and Maria Tomczyk, both with the state. Good morning.
Good morning.
Morning.
All right. Let's begin our coverage of this last week's news, starting with local and nonprofit insurers here in Washington.
Yeah, two of the biggest nonprofit insurers in Washington state, it turns out, have record surpluses. Premera Blue Cross and Regents Blue Shield each have over about $1 billion in surplus cash, and this is way more than they need for reserves. This is as premium rates in Washington state are continuing to increase. For example,
at double-digit rates.
Yeah. For example, the cost of individual health plans in this state has more than doubled from 2005 to 2011. Now, Premera's surplus averages out to be about $700 per member. So why aren't these insurance companies, these so-called nonprofit insurance companies, dropping their rates for people? Well,
it's a free market.
Yeah, they say. Premera and Regents say they can't cut premiums because this gives consumers a, quote, false sense that healthcare costs are decreasing. Well, hey, you know.
We wouldn't want that, would we?
Maybe healthcare costs are decreasing. You know, it's a recession. There are fewer people who are insured. Fewer people are going to the doctor because they can't afford to pay the co-pays or the deductibles. A lot of people are giving up their lower deductible plans because they're too expensive, and they're opting for higher deductible plans, which means they have to pay a lot more out of pocket, and hence the insurance company is reimbursing less. So if healthcare costs for that nonprofit insurer are actually dropping, rates should drop as well.
Well, I for one am grateful that our health insurance overlords are looking out for our mental health by preventing us from getting a sense of false security that they might not be screwing us.
Yeah, really. Insurance Commissioner Mike Kreidler, he's been wanting the legislature, the state legislature, to pass a law allowing the insurance commissioner in Washington state to take into account insurance company surpluses whenever they submit a premium increase to the insurance commissioner for approval or denial. Currently, he doesn't have the power to look at that and take that into account. But in 11 other states in the U.S., insurance commissioners do have the ability to do that. And Kreidler's been wanting the state legislature to do it. But of course, the state legislature has been much more open to listening to the insurance companies
This is the same state legislature that a few years ago, at insurance companies' request, decided that chronically ill people didn't need to be covered by health insurance.
And yeah,
therefore,
crazy.
They, at a time of great budget cutbacks, set up a high-risk pool in Washington state specifically so the insurance companies wouldn't have to carry that horrible burden.
Yeah.
All right. Anything else on that?
No.
All right. Mayor Mike McGinn, East Coast Junket.
Oh, yeah. This week, Mayor McGinn has been on his expensive East Coast jaunt on the taxpayer's dime. First, he visited NBA Commissioner David Stern in New York City to lobby for a basketball team. What I want to ask is why does he think that the city of Seattle taxpayers would particularly want to pay for him to do that?
And how is he going to accomplish anything at that couldn't be accomplished, say, by Skype?
Yeah, exactly. And secondly, after he got done with his little schmoozing trip to David Stern, he went down to Washington D.C. to see Assistant Attorney General Thomas Perez, who heads up the Department of Justice's Civil Rights Division. This, of course, had to do with the negotiations over police reforms at the Seattle Police Department. What this tells me is that McGinn is trying to go over the head of local U.S. Attorney Jenny Durkin, the person he should be negotiating with. In the meantime, at exactly the same time McGinn was meeting with Perez, Durkin was getting ready to meet with the Seattle City Council. Now, the Seattle City Council Public Safety Committee pulled out of the negotiations between McGinn and the U.S. Department of Justice because the city council complained that McGinn and Chief Diaz were not allowing any input from the city council and were not listening to them and were not keeping them in the loop over the negotiations and what the city of Seattle was holding out for. So while McGinn was trying to go over Durkin's head, Durkin was doing an end run around McGinn. So it's not boding very well for the negotiations to see the two main parties in the negotiations avoiding each other like that.
And I will say flatly that McGinn's apologetics for the problems of SPD really should disqualify him from being reelected next year, no matter what else he has or has not done.
Yeah, and so this week McGinn is ending his trip in Orlando, Florida, where the mayor's conference is being held this year. Of course, I want to point out, too, the mayor's conference is a little national venue for mayors to get together and schmooze in search of higher office.
Yeah, so in other words, he packed knee pads on this trip.
Yes, he did.
All right. Moving on, Seattle schools. Looking at some advertising?
Yeah, this Wednesday, June the 20th, the Seattle School District is going to vote on an issue that, frankly, people thought was put to bed 15 years ago, which was the policy that was adopted back in the mid-90s on commercialism in Seattle schools. Now, this was a big controversy that went on for several years over the adoption of Channel One, the for-profit commercial channel that is supposedly educational channel that is beamed into mostly I believe elementary and middle schools around the country,
and it's loaded with advertising,
and then also other opportunities for corporations to advertise in Seattle schools. And specifically, the context came up in the 90s around advertising in athletic fields. In other words, having signs on the fences and so forth. Well, now that we have the same old downtown pro-corporate clique back in power in the school district again, after some reform candidates came in and adopted that policy in the later 90s, we suddenly have this issue again where the school board is looking at dropping or actually amending that previous proposal to allow for Channel One to come into the schools and to allow for athletic field advertising. And the exact same arguments that were argued in the mid 90s apply now. On the one hand, the school district saying that it needs the funds. On the other hand, the inappropriateness of commercialism in an educational setting and the fact that.
Or even the inappropriateness of TV. In a school setting.
I was getting to that. the inappropriateness of TV.
You tend to think of school as a place where kids can get away from TV, that they spend hours and hours every week at home watching TV. You send them to school hoping that at least they're not doing it there,
Yeah, and the fact that, again, it is a captive and compulsory audience that that these students, by and large, except for the last year or two of high school, they're legally pretty much required to be in school. And, they don't have a choice of opting out. And so, what we're seeing here is, compulsory advertising, compulsory brainwashing of our children. And while, you can probably make a reasonable case that that's what the entire educational apparatus is about, in particular around commercialism, it's just not appropriate in a school setting. So in any event, this is going to be voted on Wednesday night at the school district meeting down at the Glass Palace at the Stanford Center. And so we'll mention this again in events, but people are looking for folks to come down and once again pack the school board meeting and try and stop the school board from doing something that parents and students and community members don't want them to do.
All right. Moving on, local media outlets. Changes therein?
Yeah, a lot going on in the media landscape this week. Crosscut, the David Brewster's older skewing media website and political website, announcing that it's cutting back by about two-thirds its level of content. Meanwhile, Publicola, the sort of wonky political slash local reporting website that went down about a month and a half ago, and its two main reporters, Josh Feit and Erica Barnett, moved over to Crosscut. They're going back to Publicola. They found a major donor that will help keep that website afloat for a while. So that's going to start up again. Meanwhile, there are a number of rumors coming out, and I heard this from three separate people in the industry who don't know each other this week, that there are major changes being considered and likely to come down the pike very soon at the Seattle Times, the city's sole remaining daily newspaper. They are talking about everything from massive editorial layoffs of at least maybe half of the editorial staff.
Not that that will hurt anything.
Well, there is that problem. To abandoning their broadsheet format. To abandoning print altogether and going strictly to web only, which is, you know, they were very slow getting onto the web, and they still do not have a very good website.
No.
But, you know, all of this underscores once again the fact that the local reporting in particular is really on life support, not only in this city, but all over the country. And, you know, while Publicola does an excellent job with what it can, it's two people with very tenuous funding. You know, Crosscut, has basically been David Brewster and his friends for several years now. And this
group that tends to have deep pockets,
a group that has deep pockets, but is really more concerned about sitting around and talking about what life was like working for LBJ than what's actually going on in the community right now.
Weren't things better 30 years ago?
And can't those damn kids get off my lawn?
Yeah.
But, there really is a dearth of local reporting on, say, what the city council is, what the subcommittees are doing, what community councils are doing. There's a lot of good neighborhood blogs that are out, but a lot of those are either one person or they are entirely volunteer or both. There's just a real void in terms of local reporting. And when that happens, people like Mike McGinn can get away with a lot more because there are fewer people watching what they're doing.
That's right.
All right. Moving on to national, starting with a homeless bill of rights.
Yeah, the Rhode Island legislature passed this week a homeless bill of rights. It is the first such bill in the nation. Governor Lincoln Chafee is expected to sign it. It will guarantee homeless people the right to use public sidewalks, parks, transportation, and public buildings without discrimination on the basis of their housing status, and it guarantees, quote, a reasonable expectation of privacy, end quote, regarding their personal belongings. Now, we've seen, particularly since the start of the recession, but also long before that, too, that a growing number of cities are passing anti-homelessness ordinances. Here in Seattle, folks might remember back to the Mark Sidran civility ordinances passed in the 90s, which forbade people from lying or sitting on the sidewalks. You couldn't spit in public, couldn't urinate in public. It's sort of paved the way for the homeless sweeps of homeless encampments that we've seen in the last few years here.
Yeah, a lot of the extra legal stuff that went on under Greg Nichols, and to his credit, McGinn's been much better on that issue.
Yeah, and you know, there's an estimated, you know, and there's a growing number of people who are homeless each night. There's an estimated 643,000 people on any given night in the United States who don't have a place to go home and go to bed to. Many cities have been passing these ordinances now, places like San Francisco, Philadelphia, St. Louis, et cetera. You know, they've been banning sitting on sidewalks. They've been banning nonprofits and individuals from feeding the homeless in public parks. They've been banning panhandling and, you know, instituting a lot of clearing homeless encampments, including throwing away the personal belongings of homeless people. So it's kind of nice to see the Rhode Island legislature pass a bill that allows at least some modicum of dignity for homeless people.
Yeah, I want to talk a little bit about what that landscape looks like here. And this is out of personal experience because, among other things, one of the things I do in my copious spare time is I'm president of the board of a local young adult homeless shelter. We have turned away, due to lack of capacity, more and more people every year over the last 5 years. And that number has grown exponentially. We've actually increased our shelter bed capacity by about 50% this year, and we're still turning people away. And that's happening across all age groups. And it's happening in Seattle, you know, despite the fact that the city has actually been somewhat supportive of funding shelter beds compared to some other cities.
Yeah, and homelessness breaks up families a lot of the time. When the parents become homeless, the kids become homeless as well. And as the kids grow and age, they tend to break off from their parents, or the parents, you know, push them away when they feel the kids are old enough to make it on their own on the streets. So yeah, youth homelessness is going to be up as well.
Yeah, we get a lot in particular of two separate types. One is LGBTQ youth. that have basically been disowned by their families. And another one is foster care kids that turn 18, age out of the system, and are given absolutely no resources and nowhere
have
to go.
No skills, no way to get a job. Yeah.
So you have all of this. And then on the other hand, you have this enormous bureaucracy of things like the 10-year plan to end homelessness, which is in year 7. And I would say the benchmark's well on the way to ending homelessness have not happened. Mm-hmm. But there's this whole bureaucracy around starting at the federal level and working down, which is really pretty seriously disconnected in a lot of ways from the grassroots service provision. And things like a basic bill of rights to allow homeless people to live in some modicum of dignity are an important first step. But really what is needed is resources to help get people off the streets and get the case management so they have the resources they need to turn their lives around.
Yeah.
All right. Moving on, a report out this week by the Federal Reserve.
Yeah, speaking of economic issues for families, the Federal Reserve released its Survey of Consumer Finances. This is a report that they issue about every 3 years. And what that report found is that median American families, that's the income level where 50% of families are higher than that level and 50% of families are lower than that level, so it's right in the very middle, that median family income or amount of wealth in 2010 was exactly the same as it was in the early 1990s, which is pointing to not just a lost decade, but a lost 2 decades for American families. Middle-class families in particular showed the largest losses in both their wealth and in their income levels, particularly in the last 4 years. 74.9%, so about 75% of households carried some debt. But the type of debt has changed. Credit card debt has declined, which is good news. However, a lot of it's been replaced by education-related debt, which rose 19.2% over the last 4 years. Now, the problem with that is that if you go bankrupt, your education loans are never forgiven, like credit card debt may be. Education loans are now also a larger share of family debt. They're higher than auto loans for the first time ever.
All right. Moving on, political ads. House
Republicans. Folks may have noticed this year one of the things we learned from the House president, the Republican presidential primary season, is that there is going to be a record number of TV ads this year, and a lot of it comes out of the new super PACs in the post-Citizens United era, where these shadowy, supposedly nonprofit organizations, where you don't know where the money is coming from, are funding attack ads of opposing candidates. Now, the Federal Communications Commission has oversight over this because, of course, they license television stations, and there's actually a requirement on the books that television stations, as part of their license renewal process, have to keep files of who their advertisers are, and you can actually go down to the station and look up and find out where you know who's spending the money and who's actually buying the ads. Well, there have actually been some studies. One was done by some students at Kent State of television stations in Cleveland, where it turns out to be very difficult because stations don't actually have those files readily available, and they're not particularly anxious to take the staff time to actually help out people with the rare person who comes down to seek those files out. So the FCC in April issued guidelines that would force television stations to list the funders behind political advertisers online on their websites. The House Appropriations Financial Services Subcommittee voted this past week along party lines to prohibit the FCC from implementing that proposal, even though, and this is what makes it particularly egregious, the whole idea that people could find out who was funding these political ads was one of the key arguments that was used by the Supreme Court to argue that the Citizens United decision allowing corporate money into the political process would not unduly influence election outcomes because people would be able to know who was financing the ads. Now, if people can't actually find out who's financing the ads or can't find it out, say, before the election actually takes place, mm-hmm. Both because it's too difficult to get down to the stations aren't cooperating with it, and you can't get it online, which is where most people get their information these days, then that undermines the basic rationale for the Citizens United decision. So Republicans, in this case, are trying to have it both ways. They're trying to, on the one hand, say corporate money is fine because it doesn't influence the elections, and it doesn't influence the elections because people have access to the information, but, oh, by the way, we don't want you to have access to the information. This is your democracy. Cherish it.
All right. Quickly, Alec, update.
Yeah. Johnson & Johnson this week became the 19th major corporation. We talked about Walmart a couple weeks ago, became the 19th major corporation in recent weeks to pull out of ALEC, the National State Legislative Exchange Council that has been responsible for a lot of the very odious far right wing legislation that we've seen in dozens of states over the past couple of years. So this is part of an ongoing campaign, and you can go to the website and see who's still funding ALEC and push them to get out.
And that's your nugget of good news for the morning.
Absolutely.
Let's move on to international and Spain.
Yeah, Spain's bailout last week, $125 billion loan. It wasn't given directly to the banks. It was given to the Spanish government. Now, the Spanish government had asked for the bailout from the European Union, saying, look, we can no longer keep bailing out our banks. We don't have the money to cover the losses that the banks have made on risky real estate loans. And so they asked the European Union to intervene and do something about their banking sector. And the European Union said, well, we will help your banking sector, but we're not going to do it directly. We're going to do it through the Spanish government, because we know that if the banks fail, then we can hold the Spanish taxpayers hostage to get the loan paid back. Well, the Spanish government really didn't have any option to say no to that. I mean, how can they can't hold anything over the European Union. And this week, it showed that the bailout really made things worse. This week, the 10-year Spanish bond jumped to 6.5%, which is getting close to the 7% range, which is where countries like Iceland and Greece needed a much, much bigger bailout. Now, Spain didn't start out with a government deficit. I want to point this out. Not like Greece, not like Ireland, not like Italy now. Spain was running a budget surplus. The Spanish government was running a budget surplus until the real estate, its real estate market collapsed and the banks started needing to suck money out of the public treasury. In addition, the recession brought about lower tax revenues, and so Spain started having to borrow in order to cover its expenses. So this really is a symbol of what's going on in Europe and going on internationally in terms of the economy. Here, Spain, which had been taking care of its finances, it was not being irresponsible. It was trying to save its own economy, and now it's hooked into this terrible downward spiral. Things could get a lot worse for Spain starting on Monday, because Sunday it's the elections in Greece, and the outcome of those elections could really determine how investors react to European sovereign debt.
And Greek voters are talking very much about electing parties that are opposed to the bailout.
Are opposed to austerity measures and the bailout. Yeah.
All right. Egypt.
Yeah, the Egyptian High Court dissolved the country's first democratically elected parliament this week, throwing the upcoming elections for the presidency into turmoil. The military council that has been ruling Egypt since the revolution last year now has the sole right to issue laws, and there's a lot of concern that the election itself for the presidency will either not be considered legitimate or will not be honored by the military. Now, that election between the presidency is down to two candidates, neither one of which is supported by the original democratic movement that overthrew Mubarak. One was the last prime minister under Mubarak, who's very much who represents the old regime and who is very closely allied with both the military rulers and the Supreme Court. The other is a representative of the Muslim Brotherhood, the Islamist party, which controlled parliament until parliament was just dissolved. This could cut either way in terms of the outcome of the election itself. The Muslim Brotherhood could get more sympathy because parliament was just taken away from it, or people could go for the stability of the Mubarak ally. But it's pretty clear, no matter how this shakes out, that the original spirit of the revolution last year is in severe danger.
Really, we've just witnessed a military coup, I think.
Absolutely.
All right. Syria.
In Syria, yeah. What I want to talk about is this week Secretary of State Hillary Clinton slamming Russia for selling helicopters to Syria, to the Syrian government, to use on demonstrators. Well, I just want to point out that Syria bought its helicopter fleet in the 1980s and 1990s, and that they've made no recent weapons purchases from any Russian company or from the Russian government any Russian weapons manufacturer for over 10 years, except for a small anti-aircraft defense system, which would not ever be used against demonstrators and could not ever be used against demonstrators, but it could be used against, say, a NATO airstrike.
Just saying.
Just saying.
All right. Anything else on that?
Oh, yes. I do want to talk about also the independent newspaper of the UK reported this week that Saudi Arabia and Qatar have been supplying weapons to the Free Syrian Army through Turkey's border with Syria, and that the U.S. government and the Syrian National Council have been reviewing and approving each shipment of weapons into Syria. Now, here's Hillary Clinton saying Russia's been shipping weapons to the Syrian government. Not true. And here's the United States approving weapons shipments to the Free Syrian Army and not telling anybody about it. Now, I also
in other words, let's you and them have a civil war.
Yeah, and I also want to point out that the Syrian National Council is widely understood to be dominated by the Muslim Brotherhood, and the U.S. statements that they're reviewing the weapons shipments to make sure that they don't fall into the hands of Islamists, well, that's just talk. Because, of course, we know when it comes to the Syrian National Council, you can't control whether or not the weapons are falling into the hands of Islamists.
And the other thing you can take out of that is that the U.S. Introducing weapons into the conflict like this is actively undermining the original nonviolent resistance.
Yeah.
And hurling Syria much more toward open civil war.
It is exacerbating the conflict, and it's pushing the government it's giving the government, the Syrian government, an excuse to use more force against civilians.
Hey, remember when we wanted to elect Barack Obama because we didn't like the fact that George Bush seemed to consider armed war as a first resort in solving international conflicts?
Yeah.
Bahrain.
No, we can talk about that another time. Let's just skip right to the announcements.
Okay. How about events?
Okay. The Fremont Solstice Parade, and that is summer solstice, actually, in case anybody was confused, is happening today. And the fairs, of course, that come after that. There's something called the We the People Power Festival that's happening from 1 to 7 o'clock today at Gasworks. And, of course, the Fremont Fair happening all day today and tomorrow. Tuesday, June 19th, is Juneteenth, which is marks the anniversary in 1865 of the last slaves being freed. That was in Texas a couple years after the rest of the Confederacy, because the Union soldiers just couldn't get around to freeing the slaves there. And then on Thursday, June the 21st, the last of the 7-week series of Common Good Cafe presentations at the University of Temple United Methodist Church in the U District in Seattle. 7 o'clock, Jeff Reifman will be talking about I-1103, the initiative that is hoping to get on the ballot this year. 103, I'm sorry, I mistyped it, but you're right. I-103, the initiative that's hoping to limit corporate power in Seattle. That's 7 o'clock at UTMC at 43rd and 15th Northeast in the U District.
And I know they're doing a lot of signature gathering as well.
Yeah.
Have signed I-103, you might go down and do that.
Yeah, I-103 will be at Fremont today. Rocky Anderson getting on the presidential ballot this year will be down there. I'm sure a lot of other good causes will be as well.
All right. Talking as we do every week with Job Parrish and Maria Tomczyk, both with Eat the State. And where do people find Eat the State?
www.eatthestate.org.
And you can find my material at mariatomczyk.com.